Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Phoenix, Arizona, it's time for Phoenix Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Hi, and welcome to The Naked Truth, hosted by me, Lori Corrigan, and sponsored by Snake Charmer Men's Body Waxing. This show is all about nakedness, spiritual, emotional, mental, where I pay tribute to the valuable contributions you gentlemen make both personally and professionally. It is a safe zone for you guys to speak your minds amidst this current social climate where you struggle to be heard. Today, we're looking into our crystal ball to contemplate how the educational concept known as STEM, S-T-E-M, will be a critical component of life preparation for the up-and-coming generations. To define STEM beyond its acronym of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics solely from an academic perspective is to ignore the significant impact this core learning approach has throughout all industry in general. Joining me for this conversation today is technology executive Sunny Horton, who illustrates how the emerging synergy creates critical thinkers, enhances science literacy, and develops next-generation innovators. Welcome, Sunny.
Thank you, Lori. That's a tall order you're putting in front of me there.
You know, I think you can handle just about anything since I know you outside of this little room here, too. My first question, and I'm sure is stewing about with this topic, is STEM just a fad?
Oh, I think not, for sure. In fact, there, if you look back in the last, let's say, 30, 40 years in education, there has been an attempt to introduce more technology and more technology-based vocational skills into the curriculum in education. I'm no education expert. However, I educated myself from a very early age to get my own STEM education, if you will.
And that's a great launching point. Why don't you take us back?
Okay, so...
Not to the point where you were born, though.
No, we won't go that far. I did have electronics in the womb, though. No, I'm just kidding. When I was about 6 years old or 7 years old, I started getting very, very curious about all things electric and electronic. And I had myriad bits and pieces about me that I had access to. My father worked at the Space Center, and he would bring home various bits and pieces of stuff that I would experiment with. And at any given point in the living room, I'd be sitting on the floor with a battery and some motors and straws to make little propellers and things like that, and just experimenting with those kind of things, even at that young age, and learning how things worked on my own. I think that one of the most important things that parents have to do is create that environment for safe experimentation for kids. If we don't do that, they won't experiment. If they're sitting in front of a video screen all day long, they're not going to explore their own little world or the world around them. And so I had that opportunity, fortunately, because I had access to other people that had those technical skills through my father. My father was a sheet metal mechanic, so he knew nothing about electronics, but his best friend was a banking security technician. And so I was introduced to electronics through being able to read books that he would bring home for me and give to me and let me explore. And I'd get parts and start building things. I would disassemble radios and things like that. I could even reassemble and make them work again. And so that's how I developed my own curiosity, which led to me getting into the electronics industry when I was 16 with Rockwell in Florida. And going back to that, where I talked about the vocational education piece, we had an industrial electronics class in high school. And the focus of that class was to teach kids how to repair TVs. And they were tube-based TVs back then. I'm dating myself here. Mm. I'm a bit old. But they were tube-based TVs. And I walked into this classroom and I looked at the instructor. I said, "Do you expect me to work on tubes?" And he said, "What do you mean?" I'm like, "I can do more than that." And so another student and I approached him and gave him an idea about how we could alter the curriculum, make it more modern, and make it more useful to the students going forward. And so that other student and I, my friend and I, ended up practically teaching half the class.
Oh, gosh.
And so we were able to do things like we built a new scoreboard for the basketball stadium, for example, from scratch with just individual discrete parts. And that led to being able to do more and more things like that throughout my career.
Well, career, your life. I mean, you've applied that to every aspect of your life. You figure things out. And I do know you outside of the studio here. I do marvel at how your brain functions. And is the credit mainly to your dad, or that just kind of facilitated at an earlier age what you were probably going to end up doing anyway?
I think the latter is probably the case. It's really more about having, like I said, having that safe environment, but having the curiosity to go after it myself. Now, today, I think it's great that there are actually formal programs that are bringing science, technology, engineering, mathematics to students in a more formalized way. But without that ability to experiment outside the classroom, you're not going to develop a complete understanding. You can learn theory all day long, and if you can't put it into practice, you're kind of useless. Well, not useless, but less useful.
It's not serving the purpose of learning that
right.
skill.
Well, there's actually, I should say, there's some symbiosis there. So you look back at the Manhattan Project. Oppenheimer was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but Feynman was a brilliant theoretical physicist who was also an engineer. He could put those things to work. Mm-hmm. He actually made things work. And without Feynman, Oppenheimer would have had a lot more trouble overcoming obstacles, practical obstacles, to actually building the bomb that Feynman was able to overcome through his own practical knowledge. And so that's kind of the way I see the partnership between parents and the school system, where the school system is providing the curriculum, the theory. The parents still need to foster that experimentation, that practical experimentation and learning through making mistakes and trying different things.
Wow, that actually speaks directly to, I found this little excerpt from Jonathan Gerlach, who is an Albert Einstein Distinguished Educator working on federal education policy on Capitol Hill. Let me just read this paragraph, and I'm interested in your feedback.
Okay.
Biochemistry, engineering, computer programming, and emerging technologies are just a small sliver of what the STEM workforce needs. These positions require the most skills, and we need to continue developing students for these specialized fields. But we cannot forget the larger segment of industry that relies on STEM. Construction, transportation, and even hospitality rely on STEM-developed workforce. Whether it's understanding how an engine works or plotting trucking routes, the advanced level of technical knowledge and problem-solving capability needed for these positions have become obstacles that did not exist 10 years ago. This explains why industries view career and technical education as a key piece of STEM education. Students must be prepared for any path they choose in life, whether it is directly into a STEM career or studying a specialized STEM field in college.
I couldn't agree more, and I'll give a kind of example, a historical example. If you look back to the era where our primary industry was agriculture throughout the country, the average farmer could do not just farming. They could also shoe horses. They could, you know, blacksmith. They could build their own barn. And they would come together in groups and build each other's barns. And as we came into the Industrial Revolution, we started specializing more. So people became machinists. They became carpenters. They became potters. Whatever they became, they're more specialized. And so they lost some of the ability to have those multitude of skills to be able to do anything. I think we're seeing a shift now where no matter what field you choose to go into, whether it's medicine, law, whatever it might be, you need some technological understanding of the world around you so that you can interface with the technology you're going to be using to do your job. Doctors today are using a completely different set of tools than they were using 50 years ago. And to do that, they have to understand the technology at least to some level. And it's very helpful to understand the technology to be able to apply those tools to healing people.
Even if you're specializing. If you're doing something, say, in hospitality where they do cross-train, a lot of industries do cross-train for mm-hmm. that very valuable being able to throw a warm body in there. But doctors are now becoming, or have, like you say, in an area they didn't want to have to deal with, right? So how do you make that all flow so smoothly?
Well, I think the key, like I said, the key is really emphasizing that broad technical education because it is going to be a foundation for pretty much every job in the future. Everything is becoming at least partially automated. The menial, not very satisfying tasks are becoming automated, and we're applying more the humans to more of a service-oriented, relationship-oriented type of roles. And we're physicians being one of those or lawyers being one of those, but they're still using technology to get the job done.
In school, when you and I were there, you know, if we were interested in English, liberal arts, we had to take algebra, and we couldn't understand why the heck we had to take algebra, and we did not try, and we didn't do very well at it. Yeah. Now we understand. Finish my sentence.
Yeah,
why?
Exactly. And I think any student today who thinks for a minute, I don't need to learn math, is fooling themselves, need to check themselves and to turn that ego off and get it checked at the door and walk in and take that class and learn math because you're going to need it. I mean, I use, granted, I'm in a technology field, but even when I was a COO of a skincare company, I used technology and I used math every single day. And we all do to some extent. We just maybe don't admit it or recognize it as much.
Yeah, what we did learn is hardwired and it's become part of us. But mm-hmm. if it's something we have to start, which is why you're saying integrate it now.
Right.
So it is as normal as anything else you do that you're going to be taking classes in something you think is completely irrelevant.
Right. And you know, just suck it up and learn and get interested. You know, mathematics is absolutely fascinating. And I didn't go far enough in school, to be honest with you. And I wish I had gone to college. Here, I'm opening up the kimono here. I did not go to college. I wish I had. I probably had an opportunity, but it wasn't obvious to me that it was an opportunity. So I didn't take it. But I managed to teach myself a great deal without college and have been very successful without college. However, there are certain things that I probably could have learned more theoretical stuff if I had gone. So, you know, I kick myself, but they say you're never too old to keep learning.
Right.
I don't stop learning. I'm always reading books. I'm always learning new things and testing myself, but I wish I had the opportunity to go back to school.
Without a teaching degree, as I do know you outside of here, you have such vast knowledge on so many subjects and you're not a jack of all trades. What is it? Jack of all trades?
Master of none.
Master of none. Because you seek to master whatever it is you research. So you could actually get up there on the podium.
I still think I'm an inch deep and 5 miles wide.
Okay. Well, I don't know how to go from that. Actually, I do, because you segued into ego.
Oh, yeah.
And that is what you're really keen on how we can extract it from our existence.
Well, I think the piece that I wanted to talk about, and if you feel like we've covered the STEM thing enough, we can always go back to that.
You take what you like. You go ahead.
All
right. Take the road.
The one thing I've observed in my career, and I've been in technology for, I'll admit it, over 40 years, and in leadership for over 30. And one of the things I've observed in various leaders is the contrast between a leader who's ego-driven and one who knows how to be humble. An ego-driven leader starts seeing some success. I won't name the company, but I'll talk about a company I used to work for at one point in time in my career. The founders had huge egos because they had a modest amount of success. And I say modest, they thought it was an extraordinary amount of success. I thought it was modest. And yet they had all the trappings of being absolute, you know, mega millionaires. And they would go out and buy fancy cars and fancy homes, and their wives had fancy jewelry and all these sorts of things. And they were so ego-driven that they totally forgot how they got there. And how they got there was on the backs of some really smart people that they managed to hire early in their careers, early in the game. And on the backs of those people, they were able to succeed, again, moderately, in my opinion. When their egos got in the way, they started forgetting that other people have smart ideas. And because of that, these other people stopped sharing their ideas because they were afraid they would be disagreed with by the CEO or one of the other of the founders, if you will. And so that ego stifled their growth, and they basically became stagnant and stopped growing and lost a lot of their talent because of that focus on their own self and always being right. So I would challenge any leader today to take the time to step back, get to know your people, be humble, admit that you don't know everything, admit that you hired smart people for a reason and you pay them for a reason. Listen to their ideas, implement them, and the chances are you're going to make your business healthier through more satisfied employees, healthier on the bottom line because you're going to get more revenue and higher quality and more production. It's an all-around good thing. There's so many examples out there where there's these gigantic egos and companies end up crashing and burning because that one person can't listen to anybody else.
Or that one person populates the company with supervisors who are cookie cutter.
Yes, so men. Yes, persons. Yes,
yep, exactly. And so in that type of an environment, how do you, is every business savable? Is every person able to change if with a big ego?
I think there are the exceptions. There's the what I call the dark triad. Well, it's actually popularly called the dark triad. It's the Machiavellian, narcissistic sociopath. they can't get out of their own way. They can't mm-hmm. recognize their own shortcomings, and they will just spiral into, you know, oblivion at some point. Those people probably can't be helped without some serious intervention or a major crisis hitting them. But I think anybody else can step back away from their self and start looking at how they can start incorporating the ideas of others. The company I work for now is a fantastic example. The founders of the company are extremely humble, extremely open, and they listen to other people's ideas. And because of that, they're growing by leaps and bounds, and they're very successful.
Do you want to mention them?
No, I don't want to do that.
Okay.
Not at this point. It's kind of one of those things. I didn't clear it with marketing first, so.
Okay.
Yeah.
No.
That's I'm here on my own.
You were in the middle of a thought, though. You know, this is a great thing when we have talks. It's a tangent.
I run off into different places.
Yeah. So we'll just switch gears here for
That's
a second.
That's fine. Switch gears.
The trickle-down effect, ego-based leadership on company morale and productivity. So you got the majority of people are on the right path. Our team players, that's such an old saying, they can collaborate well. But they're led by someone who, at your old company, cannot see the forest or the trees.
Right.
So they would branch off and start their own with the information they have.
What typically happens is if they have a creative idea, for example, and they've been thumped on the head a few times before for having a creative idea because it wasn't the same idea that was shared by the guys in the corner offices, they'll stop at that point and stifle that idea. And so suddenly the opportunity to do something better for the organization or better for a peer or a coworker is now stifled because they don't want to get thumped in the head again. They got to keep their head down and keep moving forward. And that's when you get these mundane death march teams that aren't really teams. They're just a bunch of individuals moving forward in the same direction that they're being guided from the top.
And then you'll have a handful of innovators.
And they'll leave.
Start their own thing and ultimately become a competitor.
Yes, and probably crush the bug.
See, now there is a solution for when the bug cannot be changed.
Yeah.
So, and from that point, how do you practice humility in order to keep yourself open to new ideas? And that would be you and also the general you.
Yeah, I think the key thing for me personally, I look back at all my mistakes. And recognize that
you can remember all your mistakes.
Well,
who are you?
All my big ones, all the expensive ones. I've had a few of those.
Expensive in money or in peace of mind.
Money, peace of mind, emotional turmoil, whatever it might be. But I look back on those and recognize, okay, I learned something from that, and that takes humility to be able to accept that you made a mistake, and accept that that's how you move forward, and you start to condition yourself to understand that making mistakes is the best way to move forward. And if you never make a mistake, you're not trying hard enough.
That's a good point. Say that again.
If you're not making any mistakes, you're not trying hard enough.
Right.
Right. So if there's not enough effort, if you're not running into walls. Mm-hmm. And so being able to have that mindset is, I think, key to being agile, being flexible, being open to change. If you don't have that mindset, if you think that you're perfect and you think that you're the reason for the success of your organization around you, you're getting into dangerous territory because you're suddenly being delusional, honestly. And that will take you down to a fall.
So now to help those who thump on other people's ideas, what are some of the things today's leaders can do to make sure they're not letting ego get the best of them and their companies?
Get out of the corner office. Get in front of your people and listen to them. Truly listen to them. Don't talk down to them. Don't talk at them. There was a really nice article in Harvard Business Review recently that I read that kind of triggered my wanting to talk about this anyway. And it talked about this banking executive that went into overseas, and it was somewhere in Asia. I don't remember exactly where. But part of the culture for that particular executive's role was to go out to the branches and browbeat them about cost savings, like cut costs, cut costs, cut costs. And they had a tradition for going out and having these visits every quarter or whatever it was. Let's say it's every quarter just for the sake of having a rhythm to it. And the bank employees just dreaded it because it was this, you know, just this big pressure to cut costs. And this one gentleman who got that role and found out that was the tradition decided to break tradition. And he would go to these branches, and instead of having it a planned meeting, he would go on a surprise. And he would start the day with cooking them breakfast. He would cook the branch employees breakfast. Then he would sit down and ask them, how can I make your branch perform better? How can I help you make your branch perform better? And after a few of these meetings, the employees started opening up and saying, okay, this is real. He wants to hear our ideas. Wow, what a concept. And so they were able to start having the input that they needed, and performance of the bank went through the roof. It was just it was an obvious thing that was sitting there latent and nascent because of the cultural boundaries that they were facing. You know, the cultural expectation that it's a beat down meeting every quarter instead of, hey, let's collaborate and find out how to make this branch perform better and the bank perform better as a whole.
That can be taken to every industry. I'm just thinking of all the places where if you have the collaboration from the top down, and like in your business right now where you're working, having known you before you worked there, there was a shift in your persona.
Yep.
You're a different person from the inside out when somebody is actually valuing you more than just you producing for them.
Right. So when ego is in the way, everyone else except that leader at the top who's got the big ego, everyone else becomes a means to an end. And they start to recognize that. And then when they recognize that, they become less productive, less happy, more interested in trying to find a way out, mm-hmm. for example. And they're not trying to make the company perform as best they can because they know if they stand out, they're going to get in trouble. Instead, if you have the openness to say, okay, I recognize I'm not, these aren't a means to an end. These people have ideas. They have thoughts. They do this work every day. They probably know it better than I do. Let me listen to them and see what I can do to help them make the company better.
And then taking that all the way down to psychological and physical impact, the company will have fewer sick days,
yep.
fewer secrets going on behind their backs. Mm-hmm. It just, that trickle down is incredible.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at, let's take a very public example, Satya Nadella at Microsoft. He totally changed the culture of Microsoft. When Steve Ballmer was there, it was managed by fear. Let's face it, their top executives lived in fear every single day, and in the mid-level executives as well. But now with Nadella, he is actually listening to people. He wants to hear their ideas. He is a brilliant man in that regard, and he's a great leader and well-respected. There are people I know who've worked for Microsoft for 25 or plus years, and they love him. They adore him.
To actually say those words
yes.
about someone who is your superior
yes.
is crazy.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, step by step.
Yeah.
Step by step. Give somebody who may be teetering on having enough people tell him or suggest to her that things need to change, people they listen to, and they just say change. They don't really say how. What's the first thing?
I think the first thing is to look inside yourself again. You have to understand what it is, the behaviors you're doing that are ego-driven, the things when you start to think, I did this, this is my company, and, instead of saying we, my team, you say I a lot. That's the first sign, right? Yeah. Until you can say my team or us or we every single time, then you're probably still trapped a little bit in ego.
At what point would you want to have that round table with your staff? Would you seek out input from other equal players in your field before?
So you're saying someone who was stuck in the ego thing and trying to find a way out?
And wants to, yeah. And so go to a professional to help or go to someone who's done it or just sit down and then talk first and find out what your people have to say.
There's lots of good coaches and mentors out there, but this is definitely a do-it-yourself thing too. It could be a do-it-yourself thing. You just have to have the humility. Just demonstrate humility, true, honest humility.
That takes
it takes courage
for some people.
It takes courage.
They don't know how to do it because they've not
had it. It takes more courage than being an egotistical leader. To be humble. It takes a lot more courage.
And where would you say you're on that spectrum?
Because
I know you, so
yeah.
You be honest.
Well, in my current role, I don't have any direct reports. But in my past leadership roles, I was always very open. In fact, I rarely would take credit for something that I did. Rarely. Because I wanted to find somebody else who I could lift up and bring them up around me. Because that was a sign of a good leader, was lifting people up. And not just being that one sole guy out there. Because until you can build a team of people that are high performing, you aren't a good leader.
Mm-hmm. And those people you want to spend time with, perhaps outside of work, which is not such taboo.
Mm-hmm.
Not when you're doing that in a an emotionally uplifting way as human beings. Just to go off a little bit on track here, what do you think about socializing?
I think it's great. In my current company, we have a lot of social activities. We do at least one big activity a month with the entire team that's based here in Arizona. And we'll do some sort of social activity or games or a casino night or cornhole, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. We have a very big facility that it's open. We can do that kind of thing. You can have a cornhole tournament, for example. And
how good are you at that?
I'm not great at it, but my boss is the champion. He is the best. And he's phenomenal. He's a great guy. But we have a lot of fun together. We actually do socialize. We used to go bowling every Wednesday night until we got kicked out of the bowling alley, which that's another story.
Oh, no. Just bullet points. Why?
walking down the lane to retrieve a ball that was stuck in the gutter, having balls end up in the wrong lane when you release them.
Oops. Accidentally? On purpose?
Accidentally.
On purpose.
Being way too loud and raucous when you had too many pitchers of beer. And hugging a lot.
Okay, so out of all of that, hugging a lot, I so did not expect to hear, but I'm so pleased to hear it. So yeah. You truly care about the people
you
work with.
Yeah, we do.
And that comes from the top down. Mm-hmm. Even though you would care about someone in a very hostile and toxic environment, you're so shut down that the relationships you have with people around you are very finite.
Right. Fear is a prison. And until you can get rid of fear in the workplace, people being afraid of being criticized or knocked down or kicked out, until you can eliminate that, you're not going to unleash the creativity of your people and the power of them to do good things for your company.
Yeah, because you're in survival mode.
Yep.
Just in the hormonal releases in your
it's
body.
Fight or flight.
Absolutely.
It's fight or flight.
And you're constantly in it. And so it makes your home life miserable.
It exhausts you. It creates stress. It creates health problems. There you go. Healthcare costs go through the roof.
Yep. Yep. Somebody who doesn't understand that doesn't understand that. Mm. Is there anything else you'd like to say?
Well, I can't think of anything else at this point. My voice is starting to go a little bit.
I hear that.
Told you, I developed a little bit of a chest cold overnight.
Oh, there's some peppermint candy for you.
Oh, no, that's okay. I'll start speaking with a lisp or something.
Is there any reason you would want any of the listeners to contact you?
No, not specifically. I'm just glad to have the opportunity to share some opinions, and I'm glad you invited me here. It's been fun.
You're just a regular guy who has thoughts and wants to get them out there.
Regular guy who thinks about a lot of different things, and I read a lot of different books. And if you want to connect with me on LinkedIn and reach out and have a chat about something, I'm glad to do that. I'm very busy in my day life, but at the same time, I also make time for other people.
How do you spell your name? What's your
Sonny, last name Horton, Horton.
On LinkedIn?
On LinkedIn.
Okay. Today, we were with this very interesting fellow who has so much more to say. We could have you back probably for five different consecutive, and that's just touching.
That would be boring, Lori.
Why?
Because I can just keep going on. Same voice, over and over, droning on, you know.
No. We'll see. We'll find something to bring you back for. In the meantime, you've been listening to The Naked Truth, hosted by me, Lori Corrigan, and sponsored by Snake Charmer Men's Body Waxing. This show is all about nakedness, but Sunny is dressed, and so am I, and so is Kendra, our producer. But we do have naked spiritual, emotional, and mental talks here, where I pay tribute to the valuable contributions gentlemen make, both personally and professionally. It's a safe zone for you guys to speak your minds amidst this current social climate where you struggle to be heard. Until next time.